business. Anyway, we will. This is another thing for another time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start this one a bit differently. If you've listened to any of the podcasts, which don't, I'm not offended if you haven't, I normally start with a question, which is, who is the first person to make you feel like you had talent? But in this instance, I feel like that's the wrong context, because the reason we're opposite each other right now is because my business coach called me up. I had a bit of a problem with some of our positioning. And I said, oh, I don't know how to get right. He was like, I'm going to stop you right now. There is a book that I am reading. I've read it twice. I think it was the half-term break, and he'd read it twice in a week, read it and then listened to it. And he was like, I'm just going to say one sentence to you right now. Stop saying you're trying to be the best and start saying be the only. And I was like, what the fuck, where's this coming from? And he was like, there's a book. There's an author called Alex Smith. He's a fucking genius. The book's called No Bullshit Strategy, and you need to read it. And so I did. And I can hand on heart say it is the only book I have now read nearly three times, or listened to and read half, because I'm a faster listener, who's not? And I genuinely think, page for page, it is the most incredibly insightful book that I've ever read that was written. And I have written your Seth Godin's Purple Cow and all the books you can imagine. This one is just fucking amazing. So I've never said this, but I am honoured. I'm genuinely honoured to be sitting opposite you.
Well, I'll take that. I mean, this is the first time anyone ever made me feel like I had talent, pretty much. Of course, you know, it helps the fact that when a book's only 130 pages, it is quite easy to read it three times in a week.
Don't
that's
shame
true.
Me. Don't penguin shame me on this, right? It was.
It ain't that impressive.
Well, look, okay, so giving everybody context, you know, you're an incredible author, but I think what I'd love to do, for me, the purpose of today is to do what you did with that book. And that is make strategy, which has always been, for me, something that seems to have a moat around it, easy to understand. From what I understand, the book is positioned to business owners or people that are trying to position their business rather than communication strategists. So I think let's presume that the audience is that, really. Mm. Because as a business owner and, you know, someone that's weirdly become really interested in business strategy and how to position yourself, it was an incredibly helpful book. And I know when you and I had a conversation, it felt like that was the audience that you were looking for the book to resonate with. So I want you to talk to me like I am as thick as I am throughout today. And the reason this podcast is called Untalented is because I want you to sound as untalented as possible and as relatable as possible. I realise there'll be some moments, and the thing that you've done brilliantly in this book is to de-jargonise things. So I can imagine we're going to have a very de-jargoned conversation. If I pick up on some jargon, I will prod you and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, you do that. But it shouldn't be too difficult, because I never learned the jargon in the first place.
Very
true. This is my sort of... my advantage is that I'm very uneducated. And so that means that I can only explain things the way that I've thought about them, not the way that I read them in a textbook. And I guess that ultimately is what sort of made the book work for some people.
100%. So I think the good entry point here is the name of the book. Why is strategy bullshit?
So... you mentioned before about how the book is sort of targeted at founders, and you know, you sort of had to target it at someone, and so that kind of made sense, because these are people who are having to make strategic decisions about what direction to take their business and all of that. But it's also founders because there is a world of really good, well thought through, quality strategy, and this is the world of MBAs and Fortune 500 companies and Harvard Business Review, and all of this stuff. And if you go to those companies, basically they know what they're doing, or there are people in the room who know what they're doing, and strategy is a thing. We don't need to worry about them. But what's weird is that you go below that top 0.001% of businesses, and it's not like they're doing bad strategy. They're just not doing strategy at all. It just vanishes, right? It's a complete vacuum in the vast majority of businesses. Either they don't even pay lip service to it, or they call something strategy, which isn't really strategy. And all of this comes from, I think, this perception that, number one, it's this complicated, difficult thing, and number two, that who can define it? No one really knows what it means. It's this kind of, people make jokes about it, don't they? It's the ultimate jargony nonsense buzzword. You said, you'll catch me out if I use jargon, but the word strategy itself is jargon. So I think that the main motivation for writing the book was just to take the principles which, let's say, you might have in that hypothetical Harvard MBA, and just do the essential part of it so that anybody in 130 pages can read it and get it. And I honestly think, according to some of the feedback from people who've given it to me who have done Harvard MBAs and the like, you're getting 80, 90% of what really matters just in those 130 pages. And that really does come down to just brushing away the bullshit, which is all the stuff about like strategy that people don't understand, strategies where it's really a goal, not a strategy, strategy that's vague, fluffy, and sort of unactionable, all of these things, and just distilling it down to just like the pure source, which it really is, which is just making one big decision about what your business is going to offer that no one else is going to offer, and going after that aggressively in the market and owning that space.
I want to know more about the examples you gave of bad strategies and bullshit strategies. Just for granular examples, like, you know, when we say vague and fluffy strategies, what's an example of that?
So a vague and fluffy strategy would be something which doesn't have a clear action thing that you're going to do as at the heart of it. So let's say you sometimes get businesses that might say something like, well, our strategy is to serve the customer better and better every day. Or even worse, something like, our strategy is to unlock the incredible. I mean, that would be really bad, but you see it. And your first reaction with something like that is, yeah, okay, so what do I do? Mm. Right? So it doesn't actually tell you what to do. It just begs a question of like, okay, tell me what to do. So there isn't actually any content there. You're just sort of passing the buck of the content. Another type of bullshit strategy is, let's say, our strategy is to become the number one in our category by 2030. Again, that's not a strategy. That's something you want to happen. That's an aspiration. That's a goal. Mm. The strategy would be the idea that you have that is going to make you achieve that. So again, there's a vacuum there. There's a vacuum where the person who you're telling it to says, I don't know what to do. Anytime that you say a strategy which makes people ask, okay, fine, so what do I do? Mm. That is bullshit. It might sound good, but there's nothing there. There's no action for them to take. The reaction that someone should have when you tell them the strategy is, ah, okay, got it, let's do it. That's the sort of litmus test of a good strategy.
I'm imagining a car ad. I don't know why, but a car ad for me feels really fluffy. And it will always have there'll be a line in there, like, rather than, you know, we're taking you from A to B, which probably would be more honest, it will say something like, we're elevating your soul through whatever it is. Okay, you know.
I mean, look, in that scenario, at least that's an ad where it's can be a bit just all about the vibe.
Yeah.
But if it's the sort of business strategy that's directing what the company's going to do, you can't be having that kind of thing internally. I mean, just to really make it super concrete, let's talk about a specific real-world example that you can actually go and have a look at, which is just like, you could look at this and you say, oh, that is a strategy. So if you Google Tesla's secret master plan, it brings up a blog post that Elon Musk did in 2006, where he literally laid out, this is the strategy that we have for Tesla. And in the space of about 300 words, that's all you need. No, there isn't a single number or bit of data or jargon or anything in there. He just says, this is what we figured out and this is what we're going to do. And essentially, the gist of it is, he says that at that time, electric cars were things like the G-Wiz, and they were things, they were tiny little nippy city runarounds that were really focused on economy. Yeah. And so what Musk said is, this doesn't make any sense because electric cars are incredibly expensive. So how can you sell them with an offer about economy and worse, have it be a really unsexy, uncool car that nobody really wants, but you're asking them to pay $60,000, $70,000 for, like was the case with the G-Wiz. So he says, What makes a lot more sense is that the first iteration of electric cars should be very expensive, very luxury performance cars that are just all about being desirable, nothing at all about economy or any of that. That way you justify the price of the car and you attract people who are interested in it just for a status symbol and so it looks cool. So that's why the first Tesla wasn't like the Model 3 or whatever they have now. It was the Roadster, the sports car. That was why their first car was a sports car. Then once they built some desire with that, they dropped down to the next level, which was a luxury car, the Model S. And then eventually, once the cost of goods has gone down and once more and more people are interested in the category, they can finally drop down to mass market cars. So, right, so he explains this. This is the plan. That's exactly how it panned out. That's what they did. It built the entire electric car market. But the point is, you see how you hear that and you're like, right, well, I've got no doubts here about what this company is going to try and do. If I work for that company, I know what we're up to. And not only that, you hear it and you think to yourself, well, damn, that's a good idea. Yeah, makes sense. I get it, right? So this is what all strategies should look like. And that's just a particularly good one because unlike most companies, he actually put it out there publicly. So you can see this is the real thing that they used, not just a sort of made up thing from a textbook where someone's post-rationalized it, like what I do.
Yeah. What would a bad example of that? So just, I want to make sure we land and we're super concrete. That sounds like an awesome strategy. What would, without throwing shade at Kia or whichever other electric vehicle that tried to launch, what would a version of their strategy look like that just wouldn't have landed, do you think?
Well, Kia have actually done really, really well. So I guess, particularly in recent times. So I guess that I guess they're not the best example. Mm. But I think that broadly speaking, the most common form of bad strategies that you have, which is what you alluded to when you were talking about the book before, is any attempt the company might have to be better than their competitors or to beat their competitors. So let's just say in the car context, someone says, okay, our strategy is to offer outstanding reliability, let's say. Okay, but sounds quite good, sounds quite plausible. I kind of get that. But the problem is that all car companies, give or take, are trying to make reliable cars. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, okay, well, we're going to make a car that's just a little bit more reliable. Now, the market, even if you succeed in doing that, the market doesn't care. Because the market, it doesn't notice who is slightly better at something or other. The market only notices difference. When you try to be better than someone else on whatever metric it might be, all that actually results in is you and that other company you're competing with becoming more and more similar because you're each trying to one-up each other at your own game. And over time, what that does is it clusters the market and it commodifies it. So even if you think in the world of like talent, let's say, if you've got all of these agencies, let's say, who are just all trying to one-up each other all the time, that means, think about it, if one goes left, the other goes left. If one goes right, the other goes right. They're constantly at each other, not letting each other breathe. Mm. And over time, they become essentially exactly the same business. And then what happens is both of their profits decline. So they've actually achieved the opposite of what they wanted to achieve with a strategy. I mean, you know, the textbook example of that, which everybody talks about because it's a really neat illustration, was in the airline industry in the 80s and 90s when all of the big carriers, particularly in the United States, they were all trying to be the best at serving business travelers. So they're all like throwing everything they can at capturing business travelers because they're the type of travelers who you make the most money from. Yeah. So lounges, amenities in their seats, you know, the best routes, whatever it is business travelers want. Mm. And then over time, by and by, every single one of those airlines, every single one went bust.
Wow.
At some point. Every single major North American carrier, I think between like 1980 and 2000 or something, at some point or other went bust. Except for Southwest Airlines, who was the one airline who sacked off business travelers. And in doing so, created the low-cost airlines category, which now seems very obvious. But at the time, it wasn't obvious at all that somebody would deliberately give up the most lucrative form of customer in their industry. But that's what it takes. Ultimately, what it takes is normally you stepping back from the competition and letting them have what is theirs.
Yeah. The way that you get to that in the book, I remember you speaking about how that particular airline, Southwest Airlines, and again, I think you mentioned a shot business, like a ginger shot business.
Yeah.
So you're a ginger shot business, or you're the airline, and you're saying, you know, which competitive category are we in? And I think you compared the airline category. They went, well, actually, aren't we more like trains? Or aren't we the competitor that we're up against isn't that really expensive airline? It's more of a, you know, economy based mode of transport.
Yeah, buses, I think, was the one that I mentioned.
And then the same thing you said about the ginger shot. Rather than them go, right, okay, we're this weird thing that's competing against smoothies, and if you put that next to an innocent smoothie, you'd think, well, okay, that's a smaller version of that. That's my money. And I think you said that they position themselves against the sort of vitamins and minerals and, you know, that
kind Barocca of, and that kind Barocca, of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So if you're a business owner right now that's listening to this and you're going, you know, I'm working in the dog food category, or I'm in cat food and whatever, and the classic branding is... or the brand positioning is organic, and everyone's saying they're organic, and there's a photo of a farmer standing next to a dog, and the food is, it's made here like human food, you know, very classic branding. What would you say to that? And this is putting you on the spot, I realize. I'm not asking you for free strategy advice. But if you're looking, you've got, you know, a dog food, cat food, you know, thing right now, and most of your competition are all saying the same thing about it being organic and having photos of farmers, what would be a good example then to go, well, are we looking at the right industry, or should we use or borrow from a different industry?
I can give you an example of that, because one of my favorite case study brands is Lily's Kitchen.
Okay.
So Lily's Kitchen, their whole shtick was human food for dogs.
Yes.
And so you know the flavors were things like beef goulash and Christmas dinner and things like this. And what was good about, and then they sold to Unilever, to say, and the whole thing's a big success story anyway. They did really well. But, you know, to your point about how were they cutting against the rest of the category, well, most of the category, for understandable reasons, thinks it's important to give animals an appropriate diet for what the animal is. So you feed dogs food that's for dogs, not for people. Of course, a Christmas dinner is not what dogs eat. So they were actually coming across and actually like cutting against this and saying, well, actually, no, we're not actually going to offer a very natural or organic or even on the face of it, healthy product for the pets. Of course, they did the formulations in a way that was like good for the pets. But it was just a completely different take on the market, which then manifested in a very different product, obviously a very different brand, and a certain portion of pet owners were like, oh, well, that really speaks to me. I would actually rather feed my dog beef goulash, and isn't that funny kind of thing, than feed them, you know, beef chunks or whatever the more kind of like natural alternative would be. Now, in that particular case, you know, they didn't necessarily... achieve that strategy through comparing, through sort of repositioning themselves against another category. That is one of many sort of thought experiments or techniques you can do to try and unlock new value. So if you actually think about what non-obvious competitors do we have who we could actually attack instead of people who are our direct competitors, like the airline attacking buses or like the juice shot attacking Barocca, that kind of thing. That can be a really strong way to create new value and to get leverage, okay? But sometimes that isn't the way to do it. Another way to do it, which I think is more appropriate to the Lily's Kitchen example, is to find a way that you disagree with your competitors. So one thing that you find is that you take all these brands in a category. If you look at what they care about and what they think is important and all that kind of stuff, they're all falling over themselves to agree with each other. It's like, we think customer service is important. Yeah, well, we think customer service is really important. You know, it's that kind of thing. And that's all fine. But the only way you're going to get strategic leverage is if you find one thing that you disagree with them on. So Lily's Kitchen might have said, everyone is saying, we think it's important to feed your dog a natural diet. And Lily's Kitchen might say, okay, that's cool. I get that you might think that. We think that it's important to feed your dog food like what you eat because you love them so much.
Yeah.
Right? You see how this is a good faith disagreement. Yeah. They're not saying that a natural diet is a bad idea or wrong or anything. It's just like, well, that's one way of doing it. What about this? This is a different way of doing it. And then the customer has a choice. So what very, very few brands, they actually manage to find a way to truly disagree with their competitors. All they do is they all fight to see who can kind of agree with each other more and be the one who is more eco-friendly, more organic, more customer service oriented, whatever. Yeah. But actually, they'd be better advised in some cases to say, you know what? What if we just sack off customer service? Maybe that's not our vibe. I mean, it worked for Ryanair, right? So, you know, it's like it's always better to sort of take that road less traveled, I guess.
This is where, I mean, the book, it kind of completely, this is when it spanned my mind to go, oh my God, that is so interesting. When you wrote, I think, different beats better. In three words, you've suddenly like defined a brand new way of thinking around business strategy. Because like you were saying, with the best customer service, with the best blah, 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 different, that has a spectrum though, right? Because some people, I think you made a good point in the book where you said, don't just be different for the sake of, like, nobody wants, you know, vomit-flavored cat food, if we're sticking on that one.
It's different.
Right? That's not a brand. So how far do you push the difference thing? And, like, how do you find your difference in a category of people that are probably all claiming to be different?
Right. So I think it would be useful to take it back to, like, absolute first principles to just sort of, like, get total clarity on the terms. So everything in the book and everything about strategy, it all comes from the one recognition, the recognition of the one fact of, like, what is a business? Like, literally, what is the definition of a business? Any business, whether you're selling friendship bracelets in your bedroom or you're Halliburton, they're the same thing, which is it's a system that's been designed to generate value and put that out in the world and exchange it for value in return, i.e. money, okay? So that's all any business is. So then you think, okay, well, how do we maximize the amount of value that we receive? Well, it's very simple. We maximize the amount of value we give. And the richest companies in the world are the ones who manage to sort of find a way to put out maximal amounts of value, like Apple or whatever. So all that strategy then ever is it's your methodology for maximizing the value that you put out into the world so that you can maximize the value that you get back. And so then that is why the focus of all strategy is essentially, okay, well, how can we create value that, number one, people want, obviously, but number two, they can't get elsewhere. So the can't get elsewhere thing we've sort of talked about a bit. Like, you know, if you are offering real value, but it's the same value that all of your competitors are offering, you're in a commodity situation and you're going to have to cut prices and spend more on marketing and you're going to struggle to make money, right? So that's the problem that most businesses have. Most businesses have, on that equation, they're falling down on the uniqueness side of the equation. Normally, they're doing something that is perfectly desirable, too bad that there are a million other people doing the same thing. Yeah. The other side of the equation, though, some businesses fall down on that, which is maybe they are really unique, vomit-flavored cat food. And they say, well, we've cracked it. We're the only vomit-flavored cat food. Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. And it's like, well, yeah, but there isn't much of a market for that. So people have got to want it too. And it's very, very easy to do something different. But it's very, very hard to do something different which no one else has thought of before. That is how you strike gold.
Yeah,
right?
This is the art, right?
This is the art.
This is where someone could listen and read the book and go, it's just not clicking. Why? Because you haven't found the thing, right? Mm. And this is the why everyone's not an entrepreneur, why everyone's not a brand strategist. Again, weirding the normal, normaling the weird. This is, how much does that play into this? So when that was, again, I think in the book you said, if you're one of the companies that have a pretty traditional product but are trying to make it stand out with, you know, offering a slightly different thing, skip this part because, you know, most people are listening. You know, that's why most people are here. But if you're trying to, like, I think the Tesla thing is maybe normaling the weird.
Yeah, it was a bit like that. Yeah. Yeah.
What else is an example of normaling the weird?
Yeah. So again, for clarity on that, the like I say, the most businesses, their strategic challenge, as you said, is that they're making something quite generic, like a cereal, a dog food, recruitment agency, whatever.
And how dare you?
And they, and it's pretty similar to the other options. And so their challenge is, how can we become more different? How can we make people rethink this category, which they already thought they knew? So the strategic imperative for those companies is, okay, we need to weird the normal. We do something normal, we need to make it weird. You know, like Apple made computers weird, essentially. You know, Lily's Kitchen made dog food weird in some way. But there's a flip side of that, as you say, which is that sometimes the issue is the reverse, which is when the company is doing something quite unique, and what they need to do is they need to make that sort of be accepted and safe and accessible to the maximum number of people possible. So let's think about like Airbnb. When Airbnb had their initial raw product idea, okay, it's a platform where you can go and sleep in other people's sofas. That is weird. On the face of it, that is weird. And you can immediately think of 100 reasons why that's a stupid idea, right? So Airbnb do not have to worry about differentiation. They got too much differentiation. What Airbnb need to do is they need to find a way to take that product and make it acceptable to the market. So that's the reverse problem. That is, they need to normal the weird, right? They're already weird. They need to make it more normal. So you kind, it's very important that you recognize which of these sort of buckets you're fitting into. The 95% of people are in the first bucket because they don't have a sort of super unusual product.
Yeah.
But particularly in tech, I would say there's a lot which is in the there's a lot that's in the other bucket, and so you know when you're in that second bucket, I think people make a mistake by trying to actually emphasize the revolutionary nature of their product or how weird and different and new this is, and like all that the punter says is like, oh, I can't be bothered with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's the reverse. You got to be like, oh, look how boring we are. It's just like this thing that you already use, but a little bit different like this.
Oh, electric car. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
I've only got to sit and wait for 3 hours now instead. That's fine. It's funny. I mean, the classic in my industry is recruitment reimagined. It's that sentence in itself has been said so many times by companies. Recruitment reimagined.
It never
is reimagined. No matter what, it's still, and again, if you look at the business provision, you have humans that are going to come work for your business and you're paying a fee for those humans to come work for your business. Has it been reimagined? No. not on that basis. We're not getting them from space or, you know, they're not coming to you and working from spaceships. So I found that really reassuring. And I actually found that quite comforting in how you described it. Like, okay, I've not got to reinvent the wheel or make it sound, because the fluffier and the loftier it gets. And I have been in that room coming up with that strategy and going, this feels like bullshit. And it does feel like bullshit. And it, weirdly, like in my world, you know, creative agency and design agency, I think there's a real crisis of trying to name and what your agency does without trying to sound too simplistic, too, you know, lofty. And it always generally ends up, the bigger the company it gets, you know, the more loftier it becomes.
Oh, God, yeah. And I think that, sorry, just to cut in there, because you said something really interesting. It's one of the real time that the sort of the bullshit takes over is when people try to generate strategic differentiation purely through comms or the presentation of their business. So ultimately, it's the same thing as everyone else. And you're just trying to make it sound different with your recruitment reimagined, that kind of thing, you know. And you're trying to sort of put lipstick on the pig. There are occasions when you can get big strategic gains from something which is purely superficial, purely presentational. Like, look at Liquid Death. There isn't really anything interesting going on under the hood with Liquid Death.
No.
It's all about the branding, okay? Yeah. But that's quite unusual. Really, the strategic game is played at a more structural level of the organization. You need to actually, if you want to say you're different, there's a very easy way to do that. First, do something different. And this is what people want to do. They want to have the privilege of saying that they're different without actually doing anything different. But no, if you start by actually, in some proper, hard, practical respect, rejigging the business, then that whole sort of messaging side of the equation and how you talk about it to the outside world, that's going to become very, very easy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a funny thought experiment, which I think is quite useful, which is that one way that you can know if your business has got a really good strategy is, can you, as potentially a sort of untalented person in this space, come up with a really good ad for it off the top of your head? Just like make up an ad, right? Now, if the stronger the strategy is, the easier it is to come up with an ad.
Yeah.
And a really strong strategy, frankly, a very untalented person in that respect could come up with a solid ad. And by contrast, you've got companies where the greatest creative minds in the world struggle to come up with a good ad,
yeah,
right? Because it's about the material that you're working with. And you're not giving the agency or whoever's responsible for the messaging, the branding, if you're not giving them material to work with, of course they're going to come up with vague, airy-fairy bollocks, because what else do they have?
Yeah. This, I love, there's a quote that's, does the promise of your brand live up to the actions of your business? And that really, in a sentence, it kind of...
I've
hovered that over our business for so long, being like, okay, we have to be and do different. We can't just say that we're different and then do exactly what everybody else is doing. Otherwise, you're going to get found out. And you it feels weird in you. I've written here, unique value strategy is like one of the things I've written down, and the cascade, the way that you sort of form a way of getting to that. How is there like a model as to how you get to the unique value strategy? Or
So I'm not really a sort of a big believer in kind of models, because it can come, you can come at it a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you were being really, really sort of reductive and pure about it, you'd say that ultimately what it always comes down to is you notice something interesting about the category or space that you're in, which nobody else has noticed before. But it's something that's very obvious. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. And then you build your business around that. Like that Elon Musk example I gave, you know, he noticed something actually very obvious about the electric car category. No one was doing it though, so he could take a different path, and off he went. That's all that's ever happening. So the question of how do you actually come up with one as a process, the real question that you're asking is, how do you get that insight? How do you see something which nobody in your category has ever seen before? And this is super hard, because the thing is, we're all thinking on rails, right?
Yeah.
We all are completely boxed in by whatever the norms of our category are, and we can't see outside of it until, you know, someone does something new, and it seems so obvious with hindsight. But it's like that thing that people, you know, people always say, oh, why did it take them so long to put the wheels on luggage?
Yeah.
And how obvious is that? And it's like, well, it was only obvious when someone first thought of it, but until then, it was invisible. Every category is full of wheels on luggage moments that are very obvious when they've been seen, but until you see them, they're just completely out of the conceptual equation. They're sort of beyond the Overton window of the category. So your job is, okay, how can you start to see that? And there are quite a lot of different techniques to do that. For the most part, they're sort of thought experiments. So just to sort of rattle a couple off. So number one, a very good approach is to look for the things that the reasons that your business is performing, which are accidental. Most businesses will be doing something which the founder or the chief exec, whatever, didn't intend, but which are actually giving them traction in the market. It's the accidental advantages you have that are much, much more strategically powerful than the things that you're trying to do. So, you know, you need to be looking for, like, what are some things where we didn't really try, but that just sort of flew? Or on the other side, oh, we really tried to do that and it really didn't work, right? So the flip side of that. So this is one really good way to uncover some of these advantages. Number two, embrace a weakness. What are you already a bit rubbish at? Well, what if you became even worse at that? What would that unlock and enable you to do? What is the flip side of your weaknesses if you were to really embrace those weaknesses?
This is Ryanair customer service.
Basically, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah. There's on the other side of the weaknesses, there are advantages which haven't been explored. Like how Nintendo, with the Switch, they made a console that was a lot less powerful than PlayStation and Xbox. But the plus side of that is that they made it a lot smaller, and then it was portable. So again, boom, whole new form of value created in that category.
That's a unique value strategy right there.
Yeah. Okay. How do we disagree with our competitors is another one. Searching for things that you disagree about. That's another place where you can bring something out. Again, very hard because most people don't disagree about anything. and then a really sort of random one, but it's quite a good way to sort of prove to yourself how little you know, is you think about every category. It has certain well-accepted, well-established values which people think are important in that category. So detergent must get your clothes white, or computers should be powerful, or cars should have good miles per gallon, or whatever it might be. There are certain just sort of value territories which are the main battleground over which brands in that category fight. And this is what people get their minds locked into, and they can't really see beyond these norms of the categories. Well, one way that you can see beyond them is go and find some other categories, completely random ones, doesn't matter remotely what they are, and write down a list of what the norms are that matter in that category. So let's say you take three categories and you write down three norms for each. Okay, that's nine forms of value offering. Then take those and apply them to your category and be like, okay, well, what would this value offering look like in my category where currently it doesn't belong, it doesn't exist? Now, you're very unlikely to just put one thing on top of the other and it's going to be this amazing idea. Yeah. You'll probably have to like fiddle about with them a bit. But you'll start to see, oh, there's actually a lot of potential territory here that nobody ever thinks about. Now, are they good ideas? Maybe not. But you then think, wow, the scope for different forms of offering in this category is 10x what I ever thought it was. And there are businesses, you know, that have been built that way. Like one that I love, because they really make it very obvious that this is the game they're playing, is Lush. Lush, they basically brought the concept of freshness to cosmetics. Where did they come up with the concept of freshness? They came up with it from looking at the fruit and veg category. You go into a Lush store, what do? They lay out all their products like fruit and veg. They have the whole blackboard aesthetic. The whole thing looks like a bloody greengrocer's, except instead of apples, they got bath bombs or whatever. So they very literally just picked up and plonked a whole set of values from another category into the cosmetics category and created a incredibly powerful business. So it's not often that tidy, but it's a pretty good example of the idea.
Wow, you put that brilliantly well. I want to speak about I wrote a note on this, on the strategy hierarchy and how you built that. It's three stages to it, right?
Yes.
Okay, without putting you on the spot, do you remember the three stages?
Yeah, yeah.
Shall I repeat them to you?
let's hear how you put it.
Okay,
let's hear how you put it across.
I wrote a few quotes, my favorite quotes in here, right? So one of them is, because there's two sides to this question. One is the strategy, which, by the way, is strategy delivery and then branding. So strategy, the unique value, blah, blah, blah. And then delivery and the branding. We'll come back to that one in a second. The quote I wrote here, which is going back to my original question around best versus different and that kind of thing. I want to let you pause on the strategy hierarchy for a moment, because I've just seen my quote and it's reminded me to ask this question.
Go on.
Okay. You wrote here, stop thinking of your competitors as things to beat and start thinking of them as things to maneuver around and complement. This is when I wrote that. I couldn't believe this. Oh, what the fuck? Stop seeing it as a battleground and as an ecosystem. Genius. That makes you think, oh, actually, we can coexist with our competitors. And we don't have to be offering best or better or whatever. It can just be different. And I really liked how you put that. I feel like we've covered that one, but I just wanted to cover that one off again.
I mean, I think I would just say it's even better than coexisting. You can mutually reinforce each other.
Ooh, okay. In what way?
Because if it's a sort of like a yin and yang idea. So obviously most categories are more than two companies, but like, just to illustrate the idea, imagine if the only two car brands in the world, to use that, were Jeep and Ferrari. Mm-hmm. Think about how their offerings are so distinct that there's no competition there. People, depending on what people are looking for, they automatically go to one or the other. And even better, the qualities of one accentuate the qualities of the other. So like the delicateness and sort of the delicateness and beauty and sort of fragility, if you like, of the Ferrari makes the Jeep look all the more rugged and tough. And equally, the kind of like the sort of the cumbersome nature of the Jeep makes the Ferrari look all the more elegant and sort of dainty. So the two things are actually kind of building each other up. And there are, I mean, I even, a real example of this off the top of my head, which I think is quite true, is in ice cream. I think that Haagen-Dazs and Ben & Jerry's have got a very mutually reinforcing yin-yang relationship, because they're both ice cream, but ultimately they're kind of like mirror images. That's not right, because mirror images are the same.
Or reverse, like a house of mirror images.
Maybe. Yeah. The photo negative, whatever it is, you know it, of each other. Mm. So the more classy and natural and simple Haagen-Dazs is, the more bonkers Ben & Jerry's looks with all of its additives and fish food and all that stuff, and vice versa. So depending on what you're looking for in the category, the other brand is actually, if appropriate, shepherding you to the competitor. I'm not sure they're really doing this on purpose, but this is kind of like the way that the dynamic works out. And that's what, in a perfect market, you would have this sort of mutually reinforcing relationship between brands in the category. Now, of course, your competitors are never going to play ball with that, but that doesn't matter, because you can still play this game by yourself. And you really should be thinking with a mindset, how can we push a certain type of customer into the arms of our competitors? Because we are so wholly and distinctively what we are, that naturally there's a part of the market who's like, well, no, I don't want that particular thing. I want that other thing, right? And very few businesses have got the kind of discipline to, let's say, leave money on the table that way.
I can think of so many companies, probably more in the B2B space, more in the kind of services industry.
Yeah.
Because that is hard. You know, again, that's, you're talking about human capital that you're kind of refusing to think of a way of providing to the person that's buying it. So you're having to go, no, we are humans, don't do that thing. Even though it's tempting, we could. They don't do that one thing because we're so sure on this other thing that we do really, really well.
This is why strategy is so, so bad in the sort of B2B services space, because exactly as you've said, you could turn your hand to anything and you sort of know you could. Now, like with like Ferrari can't make a Jeep overnight. So it's actually kind of easy for them to not do that because they can't physically do it. But you could kind of do anything that just a person could do if you put your mind to it.
Yeah.
So that that breadth of opportunity that you have, people get drunk on that, and that's why they can't actually focus.
Yeah. It's interesting. By picking a lane and by doubling down on something with this strategy, and I guess that's what makes it quite intimidating, because you're like, it's what you're saying no to, not just what you're saying that you are.
Yeah. And I would say as well that it is, you get a lot of people in the sort of services world, agency world, whatever, they encourage niching down. And I'm actually not, and you know, it's sort of like, well, if you're an ad agency and if you just make yourself the ad agency for dentists, then you'll do really well with dentists. I actually don't really believe in that, even though it's it seems like it's an example of the principle. The fact is that there are other factors at play where, like, a dentist would still rather work with Wieden and Kennedy than the dentist. Dentist agency.
Otherwise, they'll sound and look like every other dentist.
Yeah, so yeah. So it doesn't really work.
I
think the better way, generally speaking, that it's done in the services industry is not focusing on verticals, which I think can often really hurt service providers. I think it's more focusing on a way of delivering. So this isn't necessarily a good example, but it's like the first thing that sort of like pops into my mind. You know, you look at how I don't know, M&C Saatchi back in the day had brutal simplicity of thought, right? So it's something that can be applied kind of to any ad brief, but you know that you're going to get a certain vibe from this agency, and it's like, well, is that something that you would like, or is that something that you sort of wouldn't like?
Mm.
So I don't think it's the ultimate example, but it's just showing that
it's a great example.
When you're niching down, so to speak,
it's more about how than it is what.
Yes, yes, or at least it can be. Yeah. And I think if I was, well, I do run, I suppose, a service business like that. Yeah. That is a much more low risk way of doing it,
yeah,
than saying, okay, we're just going to reject work that comes from this type of business or something, which,
yeah,
you're never going to do. Basically, you're never going to say no to a brief that comes in, which you know that you could respond to.
Which then means the strategy you picked isn't the right one. So, okay, I want to get into how you write the strategy. I guess that brings us back to the strategy hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
So strategy, which is the unique value that a business brings to the market.
Mm-hmm.
The delivery is the literal way that the business brings that to mm-hmm. the market, right? And then the third, which is branding. So how the business communicates that value in a compelling and distinctive way. Have I got that right?
Yeah. And to me, I mean, it's very reductive, but you just draw a circle around that. That's a whole business right there.
Yeah.
I mean, really, is there anything more that a business does? I think that you could argue that there is a third thing, which is the people side of the equation,
yeah,
which I haven't really covered within that, although arguably you could fold that in under delivery.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the people are part of the delivery system of the value.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, what are you offering? Mm-hmm. How do you offer it? How do you communicate it? Figure those things out. Boom, boom, boom. And there you go. It's a whole business. However, make it sound so simple.
Yeah.
But the number of businesses who you could sit them down and say, okay, just list me those three things. It's very, very few. I mean, of course, you put someone on the spot in 2 seconds, even you know, Steve Jobs is going to struggle to respond to that. But you should be able to, in, you know, 5 minutes, map out fundamentally, this is my business. This is what it offers. This is the unique stuff that we do so that we can offer it.
Mm.
And then the branding is just, you know, the way that you dress that up and sex it up for the public or for the customer. And I think that when you look at it, to me, when you look at it that way, it shows you, bloody hell, this is actually quite a simple job we're doing here. But we're so focused on maybe some of the tactical, day-to-day, executional bits of the business. That's where all our focus goes, that we never actually think about the most fundamental sort of blueprint for the whole company. And trust me, if you get that blueprint right, where it's just boom, 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 got it, everything's just going to fall into place.
Yeah.
And a lot of those tactical troubles, which are you're spending your sort of everyday worrying about, they just sort of melt away, because so many of those tactical troubles, they're actually symptoms of not having that trinity worked out.
So, okay. I mean, I know that somebody could go and buy the book right now, or they could work with Basic Arts, which is Alex's business. But if you were to, you know, top level, what does somebody do now? So they go away and to do this strategy hierarchy. Is there a process, or is there even an outcome that they're aiming for? I think I remember you mentioning, like, number one, they should be able to speak about it in a pub to somebody, or somebody else should be able to explain it to somebody else.
Yeah, yeah,
without
yeah.
Without you being there. Like, what are the litmus tests? Is probably a better question of the strategy being a good one. Yeah, how do you test that?
So the first, I think, most basic and most difficult litmus test, you can just go to the people in your business, speak to them individually, and ask them essentially, what is our strategy, and see what they say. Now, granted, you know, you could ask it using different language. If you haven't been using the word strategy internally, they might not put two and two together over what do you mean, what is our strategy. But fundamentally, you need to find a way that's appropriate language for your business to ask, what are we actually doing here? Like, what are we actually selling, and why would people buy it? And see what answers you get. Not only what is the content of the answers, but also how joined up are the answers? Is everyone giving the same answer? Yeah. For sure they won't. For sure they won't.
Wow.
And that shows you already, okay, well, at least now I see the size of the problem. Because you need to get to a point where everyone is sort of on message about, like, I know what this business does. I know what makes it different. And I know why people would want that. And I know how we do it. And I know how I, as an individual within the organization, contribute to that and fit into that. Like, that That's the target, right? So you can very, very quickly see how far short you're falling. The next thing, I suppose, that you could do, just sort of making this up as I go along, is you could, using the strategic hierarchy thing maybe, you could do a little exercise of, okay, well, can I fill that in? Like, could I actually, I, as the founder in this hypothetical scenario, well, I should know at least. Even, maybe I haven't communicated it very well to the team, but do I even know? So the first thing is, can I say clearly what the unique value is that we offer, which our customers can't get from anywhere else? Now, maybe you can write something down, but you're probably going to lie to yourself. You're probably going to say some sort of nonsense.
Yeah.
So you need someone to keep you honest, and you basically need someone to confirm or deny, do you think that you could get this from our competitors? So you could do that with your team, you could do that with your spouse, you could do that with a customer, whatever. What you're going to find is that when you write down your, you know, we offer superior service in the recruitment sector or something, and you put that in front of someone, you know, they're very quickly going to say, well, yeah, that's kind of like, yeah, I mean, I suppose that like lots of people do that. So you need a way of checking your own bullshit, because you are going to lie to yourself.
Or,
you know, even without checking it, just like really, really just try and be honest with yourself. And one of the key tips for that, by the way, is you have to, going back to that ecosystem point and collaborating with your competitors, you've got to respect your competitors. You cannot sit there thinking, well, our competitors are shit and we're really good, which is what everyone does.
You have to
start from the position, we are all equally good. We are all brilliant. The question is not who's shit and who's not. The question is, what are we actually doing? What are we actually offering? And let's just say that we're all nailing it, but what are we actually offering? That's even if you don't believe that, you've got to use that.
What are we actually offering that is different to them?
Well, yeah. Or what are we offering in the first place? And then latterly, is it actually different? Because this is where people are going to, this is really the place where people lie to themselves, in that they basically, they paint their competitors as sort of clowns, or like, oh yeah, but they're rubbish kind of thing. Or they're not as creative as us, or, you know, or they're not as effective as us, or whatever it might be. So that you're only hurting yourself when you say that kind of thing. You have to give them more respect than you give yourself.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way that you're going to hold yourself to a standard that's actually going to give you a breakthrough strategy.
So what do you think of the advice when they say don't to truly innovate, don't look over your shoulder at your competitors?
I sort of agree with the spirit of it, but I guess it's wrong, because every business is relative to its competitors.
Yeah, I've always thought that.
You've got to understand the landscape that you're fitting into. I often visualize it in my head that the category is like a jigsaw puzzle, sort of fluid jigsaw puzzle, and the shape of your business has to be just so to fit into the hole which is left by all the other businesses.
That's nice way of putting that.
So on that logic, you need to know what the shape of that hole is. So you need to know what your competitors are doing, because that's what you're responding to. Especially, you know, if you're in a category where there's a big dominant player. So let's say that you are, I don't know, like let's say you Nike is your competitor. Let's say you're a little athletic wear brand. Like that whole category is shaped by preconceptions that Nike have built over the course of 50 years. So you are operating within that environment. You have to respond to that environment. You basically have to be essentially the anti-Nike. So by definition, you've got to pay attention to Nike.
Everybody is an athlete. It's like, not everybody is an athlete.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, you'd be halfway there.
Only people that eat cat flavored vomit, or, you know, it could be an athlete. Yeah, this is our differentiation.
See, and it's so funny because, like, you joke about it, but, like, already, like, you're just taking the piss, but, like, you're closer than what 90% of brands are going to actually do in that 2 second taking the piss, because they're not even trying.
No. They're just imitating.
They're just imitating Nike because, well,
badly.
Nike's cool and we want to be like them.
Yeah.
So we'll kind of do our own play on that. So, it's hard because, you know, that kind of contrarianism, you're going to have to cut against perhaps things that you love about the category and reasons you entered the category in the first place. You know, one thing that in particularly in like FMCG, one thing that I often think now is that like things about the environment and being sort of ethical, sustainable, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's like that is not a strategic piece of leverage anymore. You might want to do it just because it's a nice thing, but no one's going to buy your product because of that, because that's what everyone's doing. And, you know, I'm not saying that you should like be actively unethical, but weirdly, actually think about it. Isn't that kind of what Liquid Death did? I know that they aren't literally an unethical brand because they're still all about under the hood. They're about all the same stuff, but they put across, let's say, a not very nice and cuddly vibe. Mm. And the reason that's worked is because we're coming off the back of 10, 15 years of everybody falling over themselves to tell you how good they are.
Yeah.
So, of course, when someone comes along and does the opposite, people are like, oh, thank God, finally, you know, there's something different here.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Wow, thank you. That's like you've articulated that brilliant. And there's things in there where I'm going, oh, shit, I've got to start that all over again. first thing I'm doing tomorrow is going to be sitting down with my team, like individually, and saying, what are we doing here? Like, how do you position us to people? Because I think...
Yeah, you got to do that.
It's fair enough to them. I want to ask you one question, because can you believe it? It's already been in 1 hour. Like, it's bizarre. What one thing do you hope will change once everyone in the world has read No Bullshit Strategy?
If you were being really grandiose about it, I think that when you consider that strategy is the art of value creation, and in principle, all businesses that are created should be contributing value to people's lives, to the world, whatever. Mm. If more and more people start to understand how to do that, then you maximize the amount of value being created. Good for customers, economic growth, et cetera, that's all great. Because the alternative, which is what's happening mostly now, is people doubling and tripling up and fighting over the same piece of the pie, which actually doesn't contribute anything. In fact, on the contrary, it's actually sort of parasitical. Mm. It's parasitical if you think to yourself, that market looks healthy, I want a piece of that. It's kind of how people do it, you know. I want a piece of that. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to fight for my share. You know, way back in the day when I was working in agency world, I did some work for one of the big alcohol holding companies who they didn't have a cider at the time. And so they wanted to launch a cider because the cider category was a sort of new thing and it was growing. And they were like, well, this is a hole in our portfolio. So they basically made a completely generic cider product, which had absolutely nothing to contribute to the cider shelf. And they didn't even pretend that it did. But because they were this big company with contacts and money and stuff, they were able to force that cider onto the shelf at the expense of perhaps some independent cider brands who were bringing a different angle, but who weren't about to buy their way into the supermarkets. No. And ultimately, I think it did well for them, you know. So it did sort of work, but you've got to consider that this is a value stripping exercise that they did. They went in there and they sort of sucked value out of the category without giving anything back in return. So
it was riding on a wave of a category, isn't it? It's like, oh yeah, we'll come along with that.
And you know, it's nice work if you can get it. If you are, you know, like Unilever and P&G. It wasn't Unilever or P&G, by the way, but I'm just using them as examples of like big, well-resourced businesses. You can play that game. And ultimately, I can't really sort of blame them if they want to do that. You know, you're sort of going to do whatever works. Mm. But 99.9% of companies can't play that game. 99.9% of companies aren't P&G, you know. They have to be value additive to the category, to the world.
Yeah.
And the quicker people start doing that, then I think you're going to see a sort of more healthy environment on every possible metric.
I love that. And like in the spirit of you coming to a category of billions of books that have been written about strategy, I genuinely think you come in with something brand new and there's an amazing angle. So my last question is selfishly, and not selfishly, it's the right thing to do. How can people find you, buy you, subscribe to you? I'm already subscribed to your email, which again, apart from Seth Godin, is my favorite email newsletter that I get. I think it's brilliant for like email for email. There's so much gold in there. So like, keep on doing that. Thank you. So there's an email newsletter that people can get from you. There is a book, of course, No Bullshit Strategy. What else is there that we can buy from you?
Well, Google, you the only thing that you can buy from me, other than consultancy, obviously, is the book currently. But I've got a sort of digital course coming out as soon as I finish it, which I'd like to think...
When you're still getting these podcast hosts trying to get you on...
Exactly, wasting all my time on this podcast. So let's call that 2 months,
okay,
if I'm lucky. So that will be... similar, obviously, territory to the book, but the book isn't intended to be like a how-to. It's not intended to be intensely practical. It's more like, this is strategy.
Yeah.
The course will be like, okay, now here, literally, do this, do this, do this, do this, spit out a strategy at the end, or as close as it's possible to get to that.
Okay.
But yeah, if you just either follow on LinkedIn, where I'm putting out stuff every day, or subscribe to the newsletter, which you can get from the website, which is basicarts.org, then you'll hear about that and everything else besides.
Amazing. Alex, thank you so much. You've been unbelievable.
Oh, thanks a lot. Been a pleasure.